out for him. He's mean. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Andy Griffith, another sensational newcomer from Elia Kazan, who brought you Marlon Brando and James Dean.
It is an absolute pleasure to have this this gentleman on the phone with us right now, Andy Griffith. Hi, Andy.
Hi, who is it, Stan or
This is Stan, and my buddy Haney's right over here.
How are you?
Good. You know, I was getting some press releases, and it's hard to believe 2 years ago, Andy Griffith is on the Billboard charts with the names of Eric Clapton and other top pop stars. And you, I guess, have hit yourself another home run. You've put out a brand spanking new CD.
Yeah. That first one was I never imagined such a thing. I think I was 70 at that time.
and from what I was reading, I mean, you started off your career. You wanted to be an opera singer.
I wanted to be at least a legitimate singer. And I was kicked out before I even got started.
But you say that was a blessing in disguise.
It was. Because the reason was, I think it was kind of God's grace. I believed that man when he said I had a lousy voice. And so, you know, I was just singing around here in North Carolina, and these were singers from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just went home and wrote some jokes. And I did them. I did a little monologue that I wrote over at the Raleigh Little Theater, and I got laughs. And then that summer, I wrote a monologue on the play Hamlet.
Sure,
I did
classic.
It over here on the beach here at Nag's Head. And I got laughs, and I never taught school again.
Now, if memory serves me correct from what I've read and what I saw, by the way, congratulations, I saw the A&E biography last
Thank
night.
Thank you.
Again, just an absolutely wonderful story. I guess you went back up to New York to try, you know, your stand-up comedy and your Romeo and Juliet story, and at first it still didn't catch on.
No, the first thing I did, yeah, that's right, the first thing I did was the Ed Sullivan Show, and I was so terrified I don't even hardly remember doing it. And the funny part is, Ed Sullivan tried to sign me up for 18 shots. William Morris wouldn't give him but four. And after I did the first one, he asked out of the next three.
But you have to admit, I mean,
I was glad. I didn't want to ever go in that theater again. I could go in that theater now and get upset stomach.
Ed Sullivan, especially at that time, though, he was a pretty intimidating man.
Oh, he was. It was okay to me. It's just that I couldn't handle it. I did that same monologue in that same theater on television some years later, and it still died. And there was a nightclub called the Blue Angel on the east side in New York, and I died twice a night for 3 weeks and 4 days.
I mean, what did that do to your confidence level as an up-and-coming...
It was awful. I tell you what happened. The next job I got was down in Miami at the Olympia Theater between movies.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of Eddie Arnold's comics. And Eddie gave me the time on the stage, and I got laughs, and I got my confidence back. Then I went to Atlanta, and I played at a hotel there for 2 weeks. And they held me over for two more weeks. And from then on, I just worked all the time through the South and over as far as Texas. And I had good fortune then in those days.
What do you take from that time in New York, though, when it was tough? What kept you from hanging it up?
I don't know.
Because you could have easily just said, "Hey, the heck with this! I don't want to even tackle this."
Well, stupidity, and I didn't want to. I didn't want to teach anymore, and I didn't want to work in a furniture factory. And I'm glad because I tried one more time with Eddie, and it worked. He's a very kind man.
Yeah, you say you owe an awful lot to him for giving you that opportunity to work the act.
One show, I forget which one it was. And I really didn't mean to do it. Some people do it on purpose, but I really didn't mean to do it. Eddie was, of course, the star, and we had only a certain amount of time for the show. And I got hot that one show. And I left him just enough time to sing the cattle call. And he never mentioned it. To this day, has mentioned it.
That's great. Hey, but you know this, too. I mean, you know when you're on stage, and when it's clicking, there's nothing you can do wrong.
That's right.
Before I ask you something else, but I want to tell you that our radio station here, 96K Rock, is owned by the Beasley family from North Carolina.
The Beasley family?
Yes. George Beasley, and by the way, he might be listening, so Andy, if you can say hi to George Beasley real quick here.
Yes, hi, George Beasley.
He's another school teacher in North Carolina.
A school teacher, started his first radio station in Benson, North Carolina.
I wonder if he's in. I had an uncle-in-law named Andrew Beasley. I don't know whether they were kin or not.
But he is such a huge fan. His whole family here is such a huge fan. And whenever, you know, they see an old Andy Griffith show or listen to you talk about the old North Carolina days, I'm telling you, they say, you tell it like it is. That's the way it was back in those days.
And Andy, I think you've given us about 5 years of job security by coming on today.
You have no idea. I got to ask you, probably one of my top 10 most favorite films of all time is A Face in the Crowd.
That was a good show, wasn't it?
I am telling you, that was your theatrical debut on film.
Yeah.
And I'm saying to myself, if you wanted to go and into that line, I mean, that acting job was incredible. That is not the Andy Griffith that everybody knew with No Time for Sergeants or the Andy Griffith Show. There was a side of you that came out in that movie that was it was so powerful, and it truly one of my top 10 movies of all time.
Well, thank you. I tell you, it took 3 months to make that picture, and Edie Kazan is a fantastic director and a wonderful teacher. See, I had no film experience at all. The first day of work on that show was the first time I ever saw a camera.
No kidding.
Yep. And his first piece of direction to me, I grabbed it, glommed onto it, and kept it all my life. It was the second shot of the movie. The first shot was just a long shot.
Right.
Second shot was across Patricia Neal in a car onto my face. She was trying to talk me into going to work at this radio station, and I was a bum. I was going to Florida and watch ball teams work out. And he said, cut. We were just rehearsing. And he called me aside, and he liked to whisper things, and put his arm around me. He said, Andy, he said, the camera is a wonderful piece of equipment. Said, it sees everything. Said, you don't have to show it anything. Said, if you think it and feel it hard enough, it'll come out through your eyes and the camera will see it. He said, now look at Patricia Neal. You don't want to go to work for her, but can't you think of something you'd like to do with her? And, you know, it only took a short while to get that scene shot.
Oh, man.
Because that piece of direction makes so much sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. But the thing that I want to ask you about that film is, as an actor, I mean, do you have to find a dark side of yourself to come out like that? I mean,
I guess everybody's got a dark side.
Yeah.
What I had to do, this is hard to explain, but I'll do it as briefly as I can.
Okay.
He would call me in the morning every day and tell me what he expected to see that day, the kind of emotions and colors that he wanted to see that day. And so when we came to a given scene, whatever that emotion was, I would just put my mind on that. And I would build that emotion within myself. And then when it came time to shoot it, sooner or later I'd hit it. Hopefully sooner than later.
Yeah.
And there were some things that were very hard to do. I was supposed to feel paranoia toward Patricia Neal.
Mm-hmm.
And I was crazy over Patricia. And it was very hard to find that. But during discussions with him, we found it. And that last scene in the show was a real tough one.
Awesome. That was an awesome scene. There is a man literally falling apart.
Yeah. 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 The gaffer, you know, the head electrician,
mm-hmm.
lighting man, I was sitting at that long oval table. And he was they were lighting and ready to shoot, and I was sitting there. And he put the light meter in front of my face and whispered, "Today's the day we find out whether you can act or not."
Oh, well, that was nice of him.
Yeah. Well, it was a strange feeling, because when we shot that first shot in that scene, the only people in the room was me and I think it was six extras, the cameraman and the boom man, and Edie Kazan. Was real strange. He didn't want the whole crew in there.
Yeah.
And, well, we got it. It took about 4 or 5 days to get that scene.
Do you realize, I mean, you must realize it now, in the era of shock jocks on the air and the Howard Sterns and what have you, how far ahead of its time that movie really was?
Yeah, it wasn't. When it came out, it was not financially successful. People didn't believe that could happen in America. Now we know.
Yeah. That great scene in that movie where Patricia Neal's in the control room as your show's ending, and she turns the pot up to sound, you know, hear what Lonesome's really saying to the audience.
That stemmed from a radio show years ago called Uncle Don, I think his name was. And he was beloved of children and everything. And he said some very nasty things that somebody had left the sound open.
Coming off of that movie and what you became and what you personified in television afterwards, do you ever say to yourself, boy, I would have liked to have made another movie like that, a theatrical movie?
Oh, yeah. I did make a few. I was in a few.
Yeah.
I never made it on the big screen. I'm not sorry for that, because the little screen is my family.
And it's been very good.
I've had a nice career on it.
Oh yeah.
But I'm hoping to do a show pretty soon that will go to the big screen. And I don't think I could ever do another picture like Face in the Crowd.
Oh, but the energy that you have to do in doing a film like that.
Kind of energy.
My God.
But, you know, Andy, I saw that for the first time like 2 years ago on video.
Yeah.
And watching that thing, you forget that was made in the 1950s, because it's so relevant, and your performance is it's so real, right down to talking about music. The scene that you did in the jailhouse where you're just singing at the top of your lungs, just great,
right,
man.
Right.
I got to ask you another question, Andy. And we had on the show several years ago the late Hal Smith, Otis from the Griffith Show, and he told us one story, and I want to know if it is true or not. He explained the time when Don Knotts left the show after 5 years.
Yeah,
and I believe the actor's name was Jack Burns that came on. From Burns and Shriver, the comedy.
Yeah, that's right.
And he came on, and he was, and Hal told us that he was going to be kind of the replacement actor for Barney after he left. And Hal said, and I want to know if this is true, he said that, thing got on your nerves so much, you said, get him the heck out of here. I can't work with the man.
It's true. It's true. I saw their act up in San Francisco. We flew up there to see it. And so we put him on, and I don't know. It's one of those things that didn't work.
He said it drove you nuts.
It did. It did.
And then
I shouldn't admit that.
And then we had Jerry Van Dyke on, who, of course, you performed in Vegas with. And
right.
He said also that he was considered as a Barney replacement on that show.
Well, he was considered as a regular one time, and we did a whole show with him. We were playing Vegas one time, and it was the second time we played Caesar's Palace. The first time we played Caesar's Palace, they broke fire laws by putting tables and chairs in the aisles. We had so many people. The second time, you could shot a cannon off and not hit anybody. And we were doing our opening number, and Jerry came out and said to me while we were singing, he said, I know why we're not doing any business. I said, what? He said, "You're a has-been."
Oh, man.
Buddy, I laughed.
You got to laugh.
Jerry is the best comedian I've ever seen.
He's a laugh a minute, I'll tell you.
He's the best comedian I've ever seen. I used to watch him every single night from the wings.
And there was a guy in TV that had a lot of tough breaks. They couldn't find a show for him
until Coach came along. He just envied his brother so much. And Dick's a nice guy. Wasn't Dick's fault. But he finally scored now. And now he's working all the time, Jerry.
Yep. He truly is. I mean, it took the right show, I think, as you know, as an actor, and especially on television, it took the right show for the public to recognize his talents
and for what he can truly do. We did a show together, Jerry and I, called Headmaster, and it was a turkey. It only lasted like a week.
But didn't they go and change that around? They tried to make it more.
I called Fred Silverman, and had just come to CBS. So I knew by the time I went on the air, it was dead. But they had a whole year with me. So I called Fred, and I said, "Tell me what you want me to do. Well, you want me to try to fix this show or start over with another one?" He called me back in a day and said, "Start over with another one." And I did. It was kind of a remake of the Griffith Show.
Right.
But by then, Partridge Family had taken the time slot, and we never could make it happen.
How did Matlock come about? I know in the mid-'80s, now that was also a time where we saw a different Andy Griffith when you were doing the made-for-TV movies, where we saw the darker side of an Andy Griffith character. And then you did the Mayberry reunion, and then right after that, the Matlock series got started.
How that came about, you know, Brandon Tartikoff was a bright and wonderful man. And I was offered 5 days on a movie called Fatal Vision.
Mm-hmm.
I played a lawyer. I didn't want to do it, but I did it. Glad I did it now. Because after Brandon saw that, he called Fred and he said, "See if you can get Griffith to play a lawyer on a series." And so that's how it happened.
And a lot, what, 9 years it lasted?
9 years, yeah.
I mean, that was longer than you did the Andy Griffith Show.
Yeah, I quit the Andy Griffith Show. I thought it was a big deal. And also, after Don left, the show became more like a regular situation comedy.
It did.
And also, I went to color, and that made it more like a regular situation comedy. And I felt like it was kind of starting to fall apart, even though it was number one for its last year.
Yeah. And I guess even when RFD came on, that still stayed in the top 10.
Yeah.
People loved that stuff, Andy. They loved it.
Well, it was number six when Fred canceled it. But I felt it wasn't up to snuff, and it bothered me. And so I quit, and I went over to Universal, and I made one picture. I think of it every now and then. Leo Wasserman. What's his name that runs Universal?
Geez, I don't know. They don't talk to us.
Me either anymore. Anyway, I went up there. I said, "Why do you want me to do this?" He said he wanted to sign me for 5 years. He said, "I think you got 10 more good years in you, and I want 5 of them." So I did one little picture called Angel in My Pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know what to do with it. It was a good picture, but the comedy, you know, they didn't know what to do with it. And right. So I asked out, and they let me out.
You did that one and dropped like 4 pictures on them. I mean, and said you wanted out of that.
Yeah, I they didn't know how to do it, and I didn't want to. It was, you know, it was a good piece of work, and my two friends, Jim Frisell and Evie Greenbaum, wrote it along with me, and I just didn't want to mess with them anymore.
Didn't they also want you to do, and I think I saw this in the biography last night, didn't they, after that film, want to team you and Don Knotts back up on
it? Yeah, Don and I tried to do a show that we titled Me and My Shadow, and the script never really worked.
Mm-hmm.
And so Don and I scrapped it.
So it was a decision both of you said, "Hey, this isn't going to work."
Oh, yeah.
But you know what? His character, when you brought him back on Matlock, is what? Ace Calhoun. When Don Knotts came on the Matlock show.
Yeah.
That, once again, though, you saw the magic.
Yeah, every now and then you did, yeah. Don is doing fine now.
He's doing a stage show.
Yeah, he may still be doing it. He goes out about every year with something.
I know it was a couple of weeks ago. It was on the other coast. I know somebody that saw him said he was fantastic.
Oh, yeah, he's good. Don's good.
Yeah, and they say his timing is still perfect.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that without any question.
Before we have to let you go, Andy, I do want to talk about the gospel, the new gospel CD that's coming out. I mean, how are you approached to say, hey, guess what, Andy, we want you to start singing again, and that it took off like it did?
You mean that first one?
The first one, and, of course, now you came out with another one, which, from what I understand, your voice is sounding better than ever.
Yeah, it's a good sound. It's a better sound than before, even. Steve Tyrell is a record producer. He's been a producer since he was 15 years old. And he used to shout the blues and sing the rock and roll like you have.
Mm-hmm.
He's got nodules on his vocal cords. He sings on this album, too. He's got a good voice. It tickles me to death when he sings. But he came down to pre-record Randy Travis for a Matlock show. And he came in my room and was playing, had a couple of speakers and a little tape, and he was playing a tune and sang with it that he was going to sing with the Glendale Symphony that Christmas. And that, I brought everybody in to hear that. Then later on, he was in there, and I had made an old record one time for Columbia. And I brought out a tape, and I played one tune. I played When They Ring the Golden Bells for You and Me. And I said, you know, I did that years ago. I'd like to try that again. Never thinking anything about it. It was just conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Steve was having dinner with somebody there in Nashville. Next thing you know, we're up in Billy Ray Hearn's office picking tunes. And that's how it started.
And it was such a huge smash. You have a Grammy on your mantle.
I won a Grammy.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
I mean that's got to give you such pride in your heart. I mean, you've tackled everything, and you were so successful at it. And now, look at this, a Grammy sitting up there.
It's on my mantelpiece.
Yeah, boy.
I put my gold record in a back room because it's too garish.
Andy Griffith, I want to thank you so much for coming on and spending a little time with us.
A real pleasure.